All right, so I'm Kevin with Rosario Bike Co., and I'm here with...
I'm Pete Verdone.
Nice to meet you, Pete.
Hi.
So, what do you think of the show so far?
It's pretty cool. I wish they had lectures, because I would have loved to have given a few. But from a marketing point of view and the turnout and the hype, I think there's a lot of great energy here for a show. And I think there was a lot of excitement leading into it and a lot of people engaged. And here at the show, it's a good vibe. It's very dark, so luckily I brought a lamp. But so pictures are difficult. But I think it's great. I think Portland's a great town for a bike show. And there's a lot of local feet on the ground interest in this type of stuff, and that really helps. I'm totally down. I think it's cool.
What's different about this show than past shows that you've been to?
Well, I've been to many North American handmade bike shows. I've probably missed 3 or 4 over the years. And I've been to the last 2 Philly bike expos, as well as Interbike at times, which is a whole different thing, obviously, and all that. And I'd say, you ask what's different.
Yeah.
Like, the North American Handmade Bike Show certainly was run in a particular way from a particular perspective in the running of it. And there was some element of competition involved with, you know, awards given for certain criteria. And this show doesn't have that. I don't know if that's good or bad. Some people have expressed that they don't, that they're happy about that. Even people that would otherwise win awards have expressed that they're kind of happy about that. But I don't know. I think... I haven't really quite decided what I feel about that. There's goods and there's bads probably in both. Like I said about not having lectures, like in both Philly and North American Handmade Bike Show, there was an educational component. And I think, hopefully if MADE does that next year, you know, because this is their first year, so I get it. There's things they're trying to do and get off the ground. I get that. But I think the educational component is an important part to these, of particularly these handmade bike show events. So I'd look forward to that. You know, Philly Bike Expo does have a custom frame build or custom bike component to it. But it's not entirely that. There's some activist stuff there. There's some regional and local stuff happening with that. So it's a different kind of show. It's also in a different kind of urban environment and like the whole I-95 corridor type of thing. But, I mean, this is good. And there's Carl. He's doing a walkthrough. All right, cool. Yeah, like how many people here were influenced by Carl Strong's legendary lectures? And it was almost, for years, it was like, oh, you're a beginning frame builder. You got to go listen to Carl Strong talk about running a business, you know? Because, yeah, it's that kind of stuff. That's why we need it. Carl's lectures were a perfect example of that kind of thing, too.
Cool. And what do you see, like, trends within, like, new builders and things that are really exciting?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm all about 3D printing, and 3D printing is definitely taking off amongst the small fries and the people just getting off the ground. It's not just the territory of the very experienced now. We'll see what happens with that. I hope it turns out well. It's definitely more competition in what I do or what I've been specializing in. And in terms of other trends, I think that in this show, like each show, like through the years with Handmade Bike Show, you'd probably see a trend happening amongst what's going on in the zeitgeist, so to speak. And I would say at this show's, it's rigid forks. I mean, of course, an all-road bike generally has a rigid fork, but amongst mountain bikes, you're seeing a lot of rigid fork mountain bikes that aren't single speeds and shit like that. And that's kind of interesting. just I think it's what's happening in the ether. And I hope people are riding them. I think there's a lot to learn by riding a full rigid bike. I've done a lot, especially as a frame designer. Like we're standing in front of your bike here with a hinge and a spring in the back. And, you know, there's things you can learn, especially with regard to suspension tuning and some elements of riding with that. But from a frame design perspective and geometry perspective, I think obviously the full rigid environment tells you so much more. So it's where you do the learning and then you bring it over to the other bikes, you know.
Cool. So what do you notice looking at this bike here?
Okay, what do I see in your bike?
Yeah.
It's a simple swing arm. No linkage. Which is, I think it's a good way in the door, but I would look forward to seeing a proper link later. It's clean. It's a Philip. Looks to be a Philip raised bike. And if you're fully into that, I think in terms of suspension, it makes a lot of things harder. I think it's like increasing the challenge, but you know, there's a certain group of people that they're all about fillet brazing and that's what they want. If that's your thing, okay, go for it. But it does make things harder, I think, when we're talking about little tricky, precise things where TIG really kind of stands out. Of course, when I came over here, you and Zach were talking about the 3D Anno Violet, as we would call it. And just that I'm of an era where I remember when that was fully a thing, and you've got it all over your bike. It's literally all over. I guess you could have probably gotten a dropper lever to match or something, but you've got a lot of it on this bike. It's actually interesting as a colored part bike, it doesn't seem like it's too colored, and maybe it's the lighting that we have here right now. But it for 3D Anno Violet, it seems subdued almost. But you know, it brings me back. You know, I was there, and I wonder. You know, we were talking with Zach. Like you weren't there. I don't believe. Were you?
No.
Okay, so you weren't quite there. And there was, I think it was a shifting in what was happening with bikes when 3D Anno Violet became a thing. It was probably when there was a real departure from Asian supplied parts exclusively to more of a U.S. part, like CNC was becoming a thing for small, like companies that weren't Boeing. You could have a CNC machine, and that was kind of coming up in American bike parts. And we got suddenly everybody around the world wanted American bike parts, and that was the 3D Anno Violet era in a sense. And that's where that shift happened. And of course, that's everybody here is kind of the in the lineage of that, because this is North American made in general. Although there's a guy from Taiwan over there. Have you looked at his bike? It's amazing. Fairly traditional in all senses, but he has a TIG bike and a Philip Brace bike. The TIG welds on it are ungodly tiny and perfect. And it's like, and I said, I was like, if this bike doesn't fucking break, it's fucking amazing. Like TIG welds on a level that I can't even imagine, right? And so anyway, I got off track there in North America. Anyway, I was kind of stoked on that. But they're ultra tiny. I mean, they're the tiniest things I've ever seen, practically. I had to ask if they were laser welded. Like, I was, are these laser welded? He's like, no, TIG. I'm like, TIG? Are you kidding? Anyway, so more about this bike. I mean, you got a nice shock on it, rear shock on it. Front shock. Handlebars look fairly narrow. Hard to tell. Is this a girly bike?
This is my daughter's bike.
Okay, daughter bike. There you go.
Do you want to know why it's got the Anno purple on it?
I'd love to. Let's hear.
Okay. So our high school colors are purple and either white or black. And she loves black in general, but wanted a little bit of color on it, and chose purple.
All right, but so we've got narrow bars to fairly small saddle height and everything like that. It looks like it has fairly long cranks, though.
It does. Uh-huh. Yeah, and the cranks probably won't stay on it for her long term, but they... Hers are pretty beat up, so for a show bike, I
got it all pretty up.
Would be
You know, it's funny. We're just dealing with that for a buddy's bike. He's got a girlfriend of very small stature, and the rival, like I do very narrow crank arms for my bikes, even my mountain bikes, and the rival wide axle cranks go down to 165, I believe, and that's a Q150. So you can both get a shorter crank, not the shortest, but shorter crank, but also that very narrow Q factor that helps somebody that's short. And it's definitely, I think, a place that for smaller statured riders, people should start looking at because there's a real gain there, you know, in terms of their experience, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's a good looking bike. Yeah, I wanted to come over here and talk, and we decided I'd be interviewed.
Awesome. Thank you.
Is there anything in particular you want to know else? You know, like, it's got to be some curiosity. Have you read my work?
I have read some of your work. Yeah, I mean, I think...
You can give me hell if you'd like.
No, I mean, I think there's some curiosity of some of your geometry things. I'd love to watch you ride your bike and watch how your weight's distributed on it and how it responds to that. And I'd really love to know what terrain you're riding it on and see that. I kind of feel like without knowing the terrain you're on, I can't really understand why it works for you or doesn't.
It's definitely true. I mean, that's a huge part of dirt bike design, like knowing the terrain, because it's very particular.
Yeah.
Where are you located, by the way?
Up in Anacortes, Washington.
Okay.
So up by the San Juan Islands.
It's a fairly flat there. We typically think of a Pacific Northwest bike.
Yeah.
But if you're out by the islands really close to the shore, does that reflect the Pacific Northwest experience, or would it be more comparable to another kind of area?
I think it's pretty Pacific Northwest. Our trails, like on our island, we've got 50 miles of trail. There's a bridge on and off, and then you take the ferry from there. But those 50 miles are multi-use only. Like, so there's no single-use trails. There's a lot of line choice, but it's a lot of short, steep, up and down. It's not built specifically for mountain bike. It's kind of old school guys out in the woods. So, a lot of technical climbing, but not super technical. But pretty Pacific
Northwest. But you can get away with a real Pacific Northwest geometry.
Yeah, but not as steep. Like, if you were going up Fire Road, like a lot of the Seattle stuff or Bellingham stuff, you go up Fire Road, and you come down something steeper than what we got.
Yeah.
And that's really not, like, ours, you're up and down off the saddle all the time.
Okay.
A dropper, you use your dropper more than your shifter.
So more like a Northeast type of bike.
Yeah, probably more of that way. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my area, I'm NorCal, Bay Area type of thing. I ride Mount Tam once a week at least type of thing in the surrounding areas. And, you know, we have longer climbs in general. They're not as steep maybe as some of the Pacific Northwest stuff or the punchy East Coast style stuff. That's a real ass kicker, but it's 20 feet up, but super steep. Ours are generally a fairly gentle grade up for a long time, and then we bob single track down. I poach trail, and I'm generally on, because we don't have a lot of multi-use, but basically I'm running from Ranger and Sheriff, and I'm riding on raw hiking trail, a lot of it, or a bootleg trail, or a fire trail, which is different from a fire road. Fire trails are meant for getting the hose from the lake to the pumper to get it onto a fire that maybe you've accessed by fire road for your equipment. So it's not meant for a vehicle to pass, it's meant for a hose to go to the lake type of thing. And those are killer trails because they go straight down, you know, they don't meander. And so they get pretty sick. Yeah, definitely double black diamond territory, but not massive hucks. No jumps. Marin is like everybody in Marin sucks at jumping because we don't get to do it much. But wintertime, slippery routes, steep sections, and good long steep technical sections when we're riding the real trail. And then otherwise we have beautiful fire road. I mean, in terms of like the gravel riding thing, it's not ag road, it's fire road, but we've got thousands of miles of it or whatever like that, and they go over beautiful areas. So if you were stoked on gravel, you could ride for just for all day every day and just never get tired of it type of stuff, and it's beautiful. But you know, I'm a single tracker and we get deep, you know, it's cool. Yeah, anyway, there you go. It's cool. I really love the riding where I'm at. I mean, I've ridden Whistler. I haven't ridden Squamish, really. I'd love to, but I've ridden Whistler. You know, I've ridden, this summer we were at Keystone. I got to ride Keystone, which was awesome. I love Keystone, but I've ridden Angel Fire. I've ridden Trestle, you know, stuff like that. I grew up, when I was young, 3D Anno Violet era, we had the Grundig World Cup at Mount Snow, and my first bike race was at a Grundig World Cup at Mount Snow, and I was in the beginner class, you know, my first race. But yeah, so I've ridden all over. I've seen a lot of riding, and I do like where I'm at. Some people get down on the Bay Area, but you know, I grew up skateboarding, so hopping fences to skate a pool, you know, perfectly fine with that. Running from cops, that's just exciting. Yeah. You know, it adds to the thrill, you know. And I underbike this stuff too. I like to underbike.
Cool.
I think underbiking's really great, mainly because, like I said earlier, we don't have big hucks or, you know, mass, that real, you know, probably stuff that you can access maybe more, real crazy shit. We don't get to have that, although we have Gil Killer single track. So then it's like, okay, you've mastered riding a trail, and you, like, I've had big enduro bike type bikes and all that stuff. And, you know, you can make a bike, you can add more artillery to your firepower and be able to ride anything and speed up the ride. But, you know, if you're maximizing fun, that's not necessarily how it's going to work wherever you are. And you can detune a bike, you can bring it down a bit, and that just makes everything harder and more thrilling. And it's like, I think more people would do well to think about that kind of thing.
Or you don't have to go, you don't have to increase the risk as much to achieve the same feeling. Like on a downhill bike, I felt like on a trail, to get the feeling of pushing it, you have to go that much faster or be on that much steeper terrain. But if you're on a hardtail, you may not have to be going that fast. And so, like, if you impact something, it's not quite as much force.
Yeah. That is true what you're saying in terms of, like, with a downhill bike, you're going to have to go bigger, you're going to have to go faster to get that feeling. With, like, say, a hardtail or a full rigid, yeah, you're not going to go as fast, you're not going to go as big. But I think you're more often closer to the edge, and the possibility of going off is higher.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's like anytime you get thrown off the bike, there's a potential for serious injury, even if you're moving very slowly and even if the drop isn't that great. And especially like a hardtail, what's the worst riding conditions you'll hit on a hardtail? And it's those, I don't know, foot diameter triangular shaped rock sections where your wheels just want to stop and you're trying to carry speed just to make it through and everything like that. You might not be moving very fast. If you go down in that section, you're fucked, right? And a downhill bike, you might not even run the risk of going down in that section, you know? So I don't know. I think anybody who's looking for the thrill in their ride is going to find it. And finding it is being close to the edge. Yeah. Being close to the edge means you might get hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so switching, Picture tables or vertical fixtures?
Well, have you seen my work? Okay. There's good things about both. All right. I think a vertical fixture, whether it's a plate style, we're standing right next to Jeff Buckles' booth there with the, we mentioned him, see, he looked up. The Sputnik Tool fixture, which is gorgeous. Generally oriented vertically. I think vertical lent itself to a time when we had, and we still do, using Earth as a reference for our angles. We'd use a plumb bob angle finder type thing to figure out, are we at the right angle? And that's great. And then we get into high access situations where someone's going to be using like you're a flame builder. So you need access. And that's a different kind of thing. And having access and being able to stand and do your work, that's really helpful. But as I've shown with my fixturing, specifically geared toward TIG welding and optimizing for full suspension designs and progressive design elements, I'm working on a flat surface. It could be oriented vertically. There's no reason why it couldn't. But these are big, heavy tables, obviously. And then what is the real gain when we're using a table raster to calculate our angles rather than earth? That kind of thing. So I think like looking at your bike, if you're working with flame, you're probably going to see a real advantage to a vertically oriented fixture with access, which is not what I'm doing. And maybe I could design something around that and narrow up the criteria, what the geometry would be that you're working around. But yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of things. What are you doing? What tool is optimized for that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you have a full shop that you're working in, or are you in a basement type situation?
I'm in a corner of a shop with my dad, and I'm in an 8x8 area, using a 2x3 fixture table, and doing everything off that.
So you're on a similar situation as me.
Yeah. You've got definitely using the spreadsheets and more things like plated out and fixed down. I started more with like using bottom brackets that were adjustable for an uneven table and building up off of that and leveling it all out, and then transferred that over to the table where I can clamp everything down really well. And I'm really intrigued by, you know, some of what you're doing and how you're measuring it, but haven't needed to go there quite yet.
Yeah, and it's also where are your priorities, what are you doing, and how much time can you spend on that? You know, one of the things that I try to focus on, or what I'm doing here and what I do, is I do R&D. That's what I like. That's my hobby, doing R&D. And whether I'm developing a new way of looking at the bicycle itself, or the way we calculate a geometry, or the way we fixture something, each one of those as an element of R&D, figuring it out, giving it a try, seeing what happens, what's better, what's worse, and all that stuff. And I love that game. It's like this big puzzle and stuff. And I've been doing this a long time also. It's like, where do I find the fascination over time and all that stuff? And I share a lot of what I do. I mean, maybe 25% is saved, but you get to look at 75%. And there's very few, in my mind, other people out there really sharing the nuts and bolts of a development program that is divergent from what's traditional or what's happening. There's plenty of resources online where you can learn how people have been building bikes since the 1940s. Like, there's all that. But when we talk about new thinking and good explanations for it, or hopefully they're good explanations for it, I feel like I'm one of those sources. And, you know, my goal is to come up with something new. And not new for new sake. New because it's better. New because this is the direction we need to go. That's the space I want to play in, you know. And but when we talk like fixture table type stuff, it's like, here you are using a building method that is exactly not the best in the situation I'm describing. And you're making it work, because you can make things work, and it's like, but you are building a full suspension bike here, which, well, that then you are helped by it, because like a fixture, even like Jeff Buckles is there, which is, you know, gives you a lot of professional space as a builder, isn't optimized or intended for full suspension bikes. And pretty much none of the fixtures out there, other than what I'm describing, does really get to that. And I think the full suspension guys really should be looking at what I'm doing. And especially, like, I was talking to the Albatross guys yesterday, and that's a really cool thing. And I mean, if they've changed a couple things, I'd probably be pretty on board with using it. And it, I mean, as a prototype, it looks brilliant, you know, like, it looks polished. But, like, the way they're going about it is, like, compacting that suspension system, a millimeter will have a dramatic effect on what happens. As you know, if you've looked into all this stuff, there are designs that are very tolerant of divergence, and I think this is one of them where you can be a bit off and it's going to be okay. But there's certain other suspension configurations where if you don't nail it, it's doing something very different from what you intend. And I think that's when the fixtures, as I describe, really help.
Cool. So last question, what's one thing that you've seen as like, oh, I'm learning from that, or I hadn't thought of doing it that way, or you
well,
know more of?
I think there's a lot. There's always a lot, okay? It's tough for me to process when I'm at a show because, I mean, this is my third day. I'm trying to just basically work media, taking photographs and doing interviews and things like that, where I have to be in a different frame of mind than, say, my sitting in front of my CAD mind. You know, it's very different here. And I'm just trying to keep up the energy and everything like that. But there are some, there's always new ideas. Which one of, and also, what is the intention? Like, there's basket bike builders, and it's like they do a lot of wild stuff and everything, and they do new stuff, but basket bikes don't matter or help to me. So if I see routing for a dynamo, it generally doesn't mean anything in my world unless I look at it and think of another use where it actually does. And I'm trying to do that. And like later on, like I have the advantage later on, I'm going to process whatever, however many thousand pictures I get from this show. And that's when I get to take a close look in real time. And I can sit there as long as I want. The show's over. I can't do that here. But there are great, there's some great stuff. You were just talking to Zach, and like head tubes right now are pretty interesting. And Zach's doing a different kind of head tube. And it's like I'm seeing a bit more. I do my current head tube design. I do a head tube press cup. And I saw, and I was debating printing those. I had the machine. And it's and I was always kind of on the fence, like, damn, should I have printed those? Because when you're in a printing environment, the more you can do, the better. And the more problems you can solve with it, the better. You want to leverage that as much as possible. But I went with machining, probably just because I'm playing it safe there. But I saw a builder with a titanium tandem or whatever, where they were doing some 3D printing, and they did the similar assembly, but they printed their cups. And I was like, oh, man, it doesn't quite look right, but it's bare titanium, and it's not the best surface finish on the print. But, well, it's validated that someone tried it, you know? And it's like, maybe I really do need to do it next time or something like that. So there's that. I kind of kicked my ass, like, oh, I should have gone down that direction. Even stuff I thought of, right? But new stuff, there's new stuff here. I mean, offhand, like across the way from you, you got the heavy bikes with their cast aluminum bikes. And I interviewed them yesterday. It's an interesting project. I want to see where it goes. I mean, what you're seeing here at the show is just Gen 2 and Gen 3. And from Gen 2 to Gen 3, they went from 11 pounds to 8 pounds. Well, that's significant. And you look at the two versions, there's a huge difference. Well, okay, what's going to happen in Gen 4? Like, are they going to drop 2 more pounds and it's going to start looking like a real viable bike? And then it's like, okay, now what are we talking about when we're talking about being able to cast an aluminum bike that's Like you're doing full suspension. What if they're able to cast sub-assemblies and stuff like that? So there's always something cool and new in terms of what are the standouts of the show. You know, certainly the Albatross is the big one. I think that has a lot of use among the people that are showing here. I mean, if they have a sellable modular suspension system that, if it works good, it's all dialed in and machined to great specifications, a guy like you can just drop it in their bike and you can focus on the stuff that makes it a bikey bike rather than all this, the crazy shit you got to do for full suspension that, you know, you've kept it to a bare minimum here and it's still a shit ton of stuff, right? So that would be cool. I don't know. I'll know later when I do my blog post.
Cool. Awesome. Any question for me? Last question for me?
Well, you told me you're on the islands out there, similar to Sam. I talk to Sam a lot, and he's an island guy. And it's funny thinking of the Canadians. You know, you've got, I mean, it's just like the United States. You've got big geographic regions with big differences between them and stuff like that. I'm surprised you're not in with the Canadians. You know, they've definitely shown up here, yeah. You know, representing, but you're close by. I don't know. I just hope your daughter loves her bike and shreds on it and stuff.
She does. Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. She'll ride it every week.
Awesome. That's great. Cool. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for your thoughts. Thanks all for right. your time.
Hit. Yeah.